This is the Relic Radio Show, old-time radio entertainment still standing the test of time, from RelicRadio.com. Welcome back to the Relic Radio Show, another 60 minutes of old-time radio for you, as we do every Tuesday at RelicRadio.com. We'll hear first this week from You Are There, their episode from February 8th, 1948, titled The Dreyfus Case. Then it's Believe It or Not with Prayer Answered. We'll finish off with what may be the most ridiculous premise for an old-time radio show, The Whisperer. In that series, we'll hear The Fight Game, their episode from August 12th, 1951.
Military court at Rennes, France, where on this 8th day of September 1899, the celebrated Dreyfus case is in its last day. The court is in recess. The judges are in chambers to make a crucial decision. Will they admit as evidence the testimony of a German agent? Captain Alfred Dreyfus stands accused of betraying the French Republic by turning over top secret information to this agent. If the German's testimony is admitted, it is certain that Dreyfus will be acquitted. If it is not, it is equally as certain that Alfred Dreyfus will again, as he was in his first trial 5 years ago, be judged guilty of treason and returned to the heat and the hell of Devil's Island. The crowd here in the courtroom in this little town of Rennes is quietly awaiting the return of the military justices.
And it September 8th, 1899, Rennes, France. You are there.
The last day of the infamous Dreyfus case. Will a French military court defy an outraged world opinion and send an innocent officer back to Devil's Island? Back to the twilight of a century, when the very foundations of the French Republic tremble at Emile Zola's cry, I accuse. All things are as they were then, except for one thing.
You are there.
You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne, is based on authentic historical fact and quotation. And now,
the courtroom at Rennes, France, and John Daly.
In this month-old trial, the tension is reflected in the attitude of not only the spectators, but also it's reflected on the faces and in the manner of 150 correspondents from all over the world, from Peru to Tibet, from Siberia to Maine. About 10 minutes ago, these very same correspondents heard Maître Laborie, the brilliant defense attorney for Alfred Dreyfus, request that the court allow the testimony of the German agent, Colonel von Schwarzkopf. Here at our microphone is Maître Laborie himself and also Colonel Dupaty de Clam of the French General Staff. Maître Laborie has kindly consented to tell our American listeners why he considers Colonel von Schwarzkopf's testimony vital.
Bon. Dreyfus was accused of corresponding with a German agent. He was supposed to have betrayed certain military secrets to a foreign power. That agent, the court maintains, is Colonel von Schwarzkopf. I simply want to ask Colonel von Schwarzkopf himself whether he ever received any information from Dreyfus, or indeed, whether he ever had any relations, direct or indirect, with Dreyfus.
And do you think, Maître Laborie, that Colonel von Schwarzkopf will agree to testify?
I've received notice from Colonel von Schwarzkopf that he would answer any questions put to him.
I see. Well, then, it's your hope and your expectation that if von Schwarzkopf is allowed to testify, he will clear Dreyfus.
More than that, he will be able to point a finger at the real traitor of France.
And that's...
Everyone knows. There is no secret about it. It was admitted by Major Esterhazy, the villain himself, several years ago, after Dreyfus's first trial. The poor dupe of the higher-ups told the facts to an English newspaper man. He said that the handwriting on the scrap of paper that Dreyfus was supposed to have sent to Germany was his own, Esterhazy. And moreover, Colonel von Schwarzkopf said, and I quote, I can swear on my honor that Dreyfus is innocent and that he is paying for another. And pointing to Colonel Dupaty de Clam, this man sitting here by your side, he said, you see that man? I shouldn't like to be in a skin, he said.
for he had an innocent man condemned.
Von Schwarzkoppen said that at the French war maneuvers 3 years ago, didn't he?
Wait. He was an invited guest of the French military. He said it to a colonel of the Swiss army. And it seems to me, in all justice and consistency, that if the French army could invite a German to witness its military maneuvers, they certainly could invite him to testify at a French court-martial where a man's life is at stake.
But, Maitre Laborie, when you presented your request, the court said that Colonel von Schwarzkoppen could not testify because he's in Germany.
Mais oui, that is a practical consideration. But the telegraph is also a practical invention. And if, as the good judges said, the telegraph is too public for diplomatic secrecy, let them send secret couriers.
And in answer to that suggestion, as I recall it, Maitre Laborie, the president of the court stated that the military code does not permit an interruption of the trial. He said, sir, that he could not suspend the trial while couriers go back and forth across Europe.
The military court provides for a suspension of 48 hours. Certainly we can risk 48 hours of the good judge's life rather than risk perpetual living death on Devil's Island for traitors. For life imprisonment is what the sentence will be again if he's adjudged guilty.
Well, now, sir, you mentioned a short while ago that Major Esterhazy was only a dupe of higher-ups in this whole affair.
Wait.
Well, now, who, in your opinion, is the real, the ultimate villain in the Dreyfus case?
It is a clique. A military clique of desperate, frightened souls. And it is a tragedy, monsieur, that they represent the army of France.
There are many villains. But the chief among them is Colonel Dupaty de Clan. He engineered it all. Du Paty de Clan. With his monstrous fancy, his complete and torturing madness. Emile Zola described them well, eh? Du Paty de Clan, this most intricate of mine, haunted with romantic intrigues, delighting in the methods of the newspaper novel, like a cheap detective fiction writer discovering so-called stolen papers, meetings in deserted spots, mysterious women who peddle overwhelming proof by night, examining evidence in a room lined with mirrors. Zola was right. It is Dupaty de Clan who conceived the plan that would rid the French general staff of its only Jewish officer. Why? Why? Because he wanted in ignorance and hatred and prejudice to find a scapegoat that would purge the French army of its own failures. What possible motive could Dreyfus have, huh? Why would he deal in espionage? Money? His family has money. They are wealthy, a man with a wife, children, position, honor. What would be his motive? A criminal must have a motive. The accusers of Dreyfus could find no motive. And how can... fantastic they acted. How fantastic to put a revolver on his desk and expect him to kill himself for their own guilty consciences. No. Monsieur Dreyfus will not oblige them by killing himself. He will live to establish his innocence.
Thank you, Mr. Lovely. Thank you, sir. The defense attorney for Captain Dreyfus is returning to his seat before the judge's bench, and here now is the man whom Maitre Laborie termed the melodramatic villain of the piece. He is Lieutenant Colonel Dupaty de Clam himself of the French General Staff. Well, Colonel, what do you say to Maitre Laborie's attack upon you?
Monsieur, if Maitre Laborie has called me a chief detective fiction writer, I can call him a romantic novelist steps into disillusion. He will soon be a disappointed man.
Then you are convinced, sir, that the court will not allow Colonel von Schwarzkoppen's testimony?
It is unimportant. What testimony can one give for a guilty man?
Guilty? You seem to be somewhat in the minority in that view, Colonel. Practically.
Really?
Yes, sir. Practically the whole world is convinced that Dreyfus is innocent.
The whole world? Has the army of France disappeared off the face of the globe? Just as Monsieur Laborie and Zola cry out, Jacques, I too shall cry out, Jacques. I accuse these misguided men of protecting a traitor and defaming the glorious name of the French army. I accuse these men of maligning the first court-martial of 1894, who found Dreyfus guilty These were brave officers and patriots who have shed their blood on the field of battle for France. While writers, where do they shed their blood?
As I recall it, Colonel Emile Zola, the writer, said that some serve France with the sword and some with the pen, and Zola has also asked, sir, what name will posterity choose and honor, that of Zola the writer or yours, the soldier?
Evidently, Zola is a passionate man, very passionate for publicity, a good way to sell books. As for me, I will uphold the honor of the army at all costs.
And also injustice, Colonel?
Injustice? If injustice was done to this traitor, which I swear is false, injustice is preferable to disorder. Goethe said that. He is as great a writer as Zola.
We never meant to get you into a literary discussion, Colonel, but another great writer, Immanuel Kant, said, when justice is gone, it is no longer important that men should live on the earth.
I said it before, and I will say it again. Dreyfus betrayed France. The sentimental conscience of the world brought him back from Devil's Island for a second trial. But it will avail them nothing. Dreyfus was judged guilty once. He will be judged guilty again today.
Well, Colonel, you heard Maître Laborie claim that von Schwarzkopf's testimony will prove Dreyfus innocent. Would you care to comment on that?
Why don't we wait to hear what Colonel von Schwarzkopf really has to say? Perhaps the judges will allow his official testimony.
Thank you, Colonel Dupuy de Clame. The colonel is now walking back to his seat. He's a slight man with an impressive Prussian handlebar mustache. Indeed, there's hardly a clean-shaven face in this courtroom. Both court officials and spectators here seem to be well hidden behind luxurious growths of beard. A small group of men in the colorful costumes of the desert has entered the court. One man wears a turban, and he seems to be some kind of an important personage. He's talking and laughing with the guards. And the guards have bowed to him and let him in. He's a newcomer to the trial. I haven't seen him here before. And he's coming right up front here, surrounded by his rather fierce-faced entourage. Let's try and find out who he is.
Pardon, monsieur.
Good people may be able to know.
I speak English, monsieur, c'est bien. But why you want to know who I am?
Well, it's not everyone who can impress the guards as you have.
That was quite simple, mon ami. I merely gave my word that I would not create the disturbance.
Really? And are you so celebrated for creating disturbances?
Maybe with people I have reason not to like.
Oh, I see. Are there many of them?
Oh, no. Not so many now. I disposed of a few thousand when I was mayor of Algiers.
Oh, I understand. You must be Régy, once mayor of Algiers, who, as you say, disposed of 10,000 Jews and massacres. You'll have to excuse me now. The president of the court has just entered. The guards have snapped to attention. Everybody has risen. The judges are taking their places on the bench. They remain standing on either side of the president. He's waiting for silence before he reads this momentous decision. If the court allows the evidence of Colonel von Schwarzkopf, Dreyfus will probably never go back to Devil's Island. If the court refuses to allow it, Dreyfus will be doomed to dishonor and again return to the torture of the equator. The courtroom is absolutely silent now, and the president speaks.
A déposé des conclusions pour que l'on accepte le témoignage du colonel Max von Schwarzkopf, attaché militaire d'Allemagne à Paris, de 1891 à 1897. Le tribunal...
J'ai tué une revue! Laissez-moi passer! Ou je vais tuer tous!
Gunshots have thrown the courtroom into turmoil. Just what has happened, we hope to know in just a minute. After the shot, the voice shouted, I killed Dreyfus, out of my way or I'll kill you all. I'm not sure just where that voice came from, or if Dreyfus has indeed been shot. The court is in an uproar. Men are shouting and milling about. Everyone is shouting. Women are screaming.
I still can't see the man who fired. The guards have rushed to the rear of the court, and evidently they're after the assassin. I can't see Dreyfus either. There's a big mob around him, and we can't get a microphone over there.
John!
Yes, John. John Hollenbeck.
Yes.
See if you can get through to Dreyfus. Find out if he's been killed.
Right, John.
John Hollenbeck is fighting his way through this mob. We'll know in a moment what Dreyfus's condition is. I think there were four shots fired altogether. Four shots, then a scream, and to repeat, a man shouted in French, "I killed Dreyfus. I killed Dreyfus." The police have drawn out their revolvers. They're working desperately to restore order here. They're meeting with some success now. A lane is being cleared by the guards and the police right down the middle of the courtroom. They're clearing the way for a tall man. It's Monsieur Cornet of the Judicial Police. He's jumped up on a table, and he's shouting for order, waving his arm. It's been shot. Laborie, Dreyfus's defense attorney, not the defendant himself. Laborie has been shot. That was an official announcement from the police. Laborie, the most famous lawyer in France, has been shot by an assassin who, strangely enough, shouted that it was Dreyfus whom he had killed. Now, here's John Hollenbeck.
Laborie's alive, John. Laborie's alive. The bullet hit him in the fleshy part of the back, but the wound's not fatal.
Where have they taken him, Don?
They've taken him to an anteroom, and the doctors are taking care of him there.
Did he say anything?
Just after he'd been shot, he said, "I may die, but Dreyfus is saved. Dreyfus is saved."
Did you find out what they decided to do about the trial, Don?
Well, Maître Demange, Laborie's colleague, wanted to ask for a recess.
I should think so.
Yes, but Laborie said no. He insisted the trial go on. Here comes Demange now out of the anteroom.
That's right, Don. Maître Demange is approaching the bar. The crowd is quieting down. They're under control, although some people are still weeping and crying, "Ah, les misérables, les misérables." The president of the court speaks.
Merci, monsieur le président. Mais Maître Laborie préfère que l'on continue les procès. Avec votre permission, je vais prendre sa place.
The court is offered to suspend for the day, but Maître Demange says it is the wish of Laborie that the trial be resumed. He's asked for the court's ruling on the Schwarzkoppen testimony, and now the president speaks again.
Que seul le président de la cour peut ordonner une commission rogatoire. Mais, d'après le code militaire, les juges composant le tribunal n'ont pas qualité pour l'ordonner.
Donc, monsieur le président,
the president of the court says he is the only one who can permit Schwarzkoppen's testimony, and Monsieur Demange is pressing him for an answer.
The
president of the court has just announced that he will not admit the evidence of a German attaché in a French court. The audience is on its feet, shocked, shouting out wildly and protesting. Dreyfus, the prisoner, is frozen in his chair. He appears shocked, and his face looks as if he's already been returned to the solitary and barricaded hut on Devil's Island, which he occupied for five long, terrible years. This refusal to allow Schwarzkoppen's testimony means Dreyfus's chances are gone. It also is an affront to Imperial Germany, as Colonel von Schwarzkoppen is an important figure in German intelligence. We take you now to Berlin, Ned Kalmer reporting.
The Imperial German government has prepared a statement to be released officially on the decision of the French court in regard to Colonel von Schwarzkoppen's testimony. Although Germany and France are traditional enemies, they have never officially interfered with one another's internal peacetime affairs. Today, however, the Imperial German government, to uphold its honor among nations, as it states, goes on record before the whole world with the following announcement. I quote, "For the preservation of his own dignity and in fulfillment of a duty to humanity, the Secretary of State makes the following statement. I declare in the most positive manner that no relations or connections of any kind ever existed between the French Captain Dreyfus and any German agent." That's the end of the announcement, and that bears out Colonel von Schwarzkoppen's statement, which has been barred as evidence. I return you now to John Daly in the courtroom at Rennes.
The official statement which you've just heard from Berlin can have no effect upon the deliberations of this court. The court retired immediately after refusing to hear Colonel von Schwarzkoppen's testimony. An opinion here in the courtroom is divided. Some observers think that the court refused to hear the testimony because it had already decided to acquit Dreyfus. Others believe that Dreyfus is doomed once again. Maître Laborie is back. He's here in the courtroom. His wounds not as serious as we thought. He insisted on coming into the courtroom in order to hear the final verdict, was greeted by a sustained ovation when he entered.
It was one of the happiest moments, by the way, of this month-old sad trial. Miss Labarie is now sitting on a well-cushioned armchair provided by the court. Dreyfus has just stretched out his hand to Miss Labarie. The smile of keen pleasure lights up his usually impassive features. Dreyfus, of course, is the symbol of martyrdom in this trial, but it must also be remembered that he is more than a symbol. He is a man who has suffered much, a man with a wife and children fighting for his and their honor. The judges are entering the court again. They've not been out long. The spectators have risen, and a hush falls over the court. This is the moment in which it will be determined whether the twilight of the 19th century will also see the twilight of the Republic of France, or instead the triumph of justice. Dreyfus has risen. At this final critical moment, his face has again become pale and impassive. The judges are standing in their places, full military uniforms, white plume in the hat of the president of the court, black plumes in the hats of the other judges, medals, gold-striped swords, soldiers standing erect in their formal bearing, their hands unsullied in white gloves. The president is holding a white paper, and now he's reading the verdict of the century.
Le Conseil de guerre, ayant délibéré en secret, déclare l'accusé coupable à la majorité de 5 voix contre 2.
Guilty! Dreyfus is guilty by a vote of 5-2. The audience gasped out a long, deep oh. The president cried out silence. The gendarmes are closing in on the spectators, and now the president continues.
Le tribunal condamne Alfred Dreyfus à la peine de 10 ans de travaux forcés.
10 years. The original sentence has been cut from 5 to 10 years.
Je vous préviens, pas de manifestation. Sortez paisiblement.
The reading of the verdict is finished. The judges are leaving the court. The gendarmes are pressing the spectators, and no one is uttering a sound. Because the president of the court ordered that there be no demonstrations, no outcries of any kind whatsoever. The court is being cleared quietly and quickly. Dreyfus was immediately surrounded by the guards and taken out of the room. And the atmosphere of this court now is like a tomb. The original sentence of life imprisonment was unanimous. But this time, it has been cut to 10 years, and two of the judges, as you noted, dissented. In a sense, this may be said to represent some measure of triumph. But still, a human being, innocent in the eyes of the world, must now spend 10 more years of degradation and isolation in a guarded hut on Devil's Island, separated from his wife, his 2 children, and his home. Messages of protest are already beginning to pour into the news headquarters here in Rennes. And so for a report on world reaction, we take you now to Don Hollenbeck, who has gone back to news headquarters.
Before we give reports on the reaction from overseas, authorities have so far failed to capture or identify the assassin who apparently was trying to kill Dreyfus but shot Mère Labarie instead. Observers are speculating as to whether the shooting was the work of a fanatic or if it was a far-reaching and well-thought-out plot on the part of the military to end the case by assassination of the prisoner. And now for what the world thinks of it all. Telegrams are pouring in from all over the globe denouncing the verdict, denouncing it as a monstrous defiance of conscience and reason. There's a telegram from the Italian actress Eleonora Duse, one from the GAR in Nebraska, another from the Protestant Episcopal Church in the United States. Emile Zola has wired Maître Labarie the following statement, and I quote, "Henceforth, count me as a most determined partisan for a vigorous fight, and no mercy to the foe when we have him down. From this day, I re-enter the arena, never again to leave it." That's Emile Zola's statement. There are protests from businessmen in America, England, Russia, Turkey, Hungary, Austria, and Germany. They threaten to withdraw their exhibits from the forthcoming Paris Exposition of a Century of Progress. And now for comments in other parts of the world, we switch you first to New York, Douglas Edwards reporting.
Here in New York, we're having violent protest demonstrations, and reports of more protests are coming in from all over the United States. The sight of a handsome French officer on Broadway in front of the Criterion Theater had created a riot. Men cried out, "Shame on France," and "Long live Dreyfus." Mark Twain, the famous author, has offered to help the Dreyfus family in any way he can. The Old Plymouth Church in Brooklyn has followed its time-honored custom of taking definite action on all public questions. It's crowded to the doors. Dwight L. Moody, the evangelist, condemned the court-martial of Dreyfus as follows. "We who are here for Christian worship condemn the trial and trust and pray that it yet may be overruled by a higher authority acting for the honor of France and in fear of God." And now for reactions in England, we take you to London, Arthur Hannis reporting.
The Daily News has summed up the trial in a brief statement. I quote, "It is no longer Dreyfus, but France herself that is on trial. And the Times, normally a conservative newspaper, burned its pages with this editorial comment. We do not hesitate to pronounce the Dreyfus trial as the grossest and most appalling prostitution of justice the world has witnessed in modern times. All outrageous scandals in history pale into insignificance beside the crowning scandal of the verdict. Just a moment. I've just been advised that our correspondent Ken Roberts in Carpentras, France, has succeeded in arranging an exclusive interview with the wife of the condemned man, Madame Lucy Dreyfus. I switch you now to Carpentras and Ken Roberts.
The town of Carpentras is an old walled city that was once the residence of Pope Clement V. Madame Dreyfus and I are in the home of a friend of her husband's family. Madame Dreyfus, why are you here in Carpentras?
Because it was here that I expected to shelter my husband should he have been liberated. The people here are not the victims of prejudice. They do not hate.
I see. Madame Dreyfus, may I ask why you are not at Rennes with your husband?
I was at Rennes. But at Rennes, Elfred feared for my life. He told me to take the children here. He did not want them at Rennes to see a dishonorable spectacle.
And now that your husband has been found guilty again, what will you do, Madame Dreyfus?
I will do what I promised to do when he was first unjustly convicted 5 years ago. I will devote my life to proving that he is innocent.
Well, is it true, Madame Dreyfus, that you made a pact with your husband that if he fights to live in spite of the tortures of Devil's Island, you will fight to liberate him?
Yes, that is true. He could have easily committed suicide on Devil's Island by taking off his hat and baring his head to the sun for only 10 minutes. It was torture to remain alive. 5 years in solitary confinement. And when the false rumors spread in France that an American rescue ship was off Devil's Island, they punished my husband by keeping an armed guard constantly in his cell, day and night pointing a pistol at him, hoping he would make a move so they could have an excuse for killing him.
The world knows, Madame Dreyfus, that it was your love and your devotion to your husband's cause that kept him alive.
He needed more than that. He asked me to send him English books to keep his tortured mind occupied. That is how he learned English. And me, too, I read them also.
Do you plan an appeal, Madame Dreyfus?
Yes, immediately. Maître Laborie, I am so glad he was not hurt. He is a great man. He will leave for Paris at once. And for my part, I will devote my life to reaching every wife and mother. I will move the hearts of every wife and mother of the world. For every wife and mother of the world would fight so that their husband, their son, shall not suffer injustice. I will tell all.
This is John Daly at News Headquarters in Rennes. We have interrupted Madame Dreyfus to bring you a bulletin. Captain Dreyfus has been pardoned. I'll repeat that. Captain Dreyfus has been pardoned. The President of France has just announced that due to extenuating circumstances, Captain Alfred Dreyfus has been pardoned in principle. It's not yet clear what is meant by the phrase in principle or what the extenuating circumstances are, but one thing is sure now, Dreyfus has been pardoned. Here's another announcement just been given to me. Dreyfus accepts the pardon. His attorney, Maître Laborie, urged him not to accept, but to fight on for complete vindication. But Dreyfus's doctor declared that his body could not stand the ordeal of further imprisonment. Here, still another announcement, and this one comes from the French Ministry of War. In a special order to the French Army, the Minister of War said, "The incident is closed. I ask you, and if need be, I order you to forget the past in order to think only of the future. I cry heartily, vive l'armée. The army belongs to no party, but only to France, and I repeat, the incident is closed." That's the end
September
of the order.
September 8, 1899, Rennes, France. Alfred Dreyfus is pardoned, but the fight against prejudice
goes on.
You have been listening to The Dreyfus Case, another broadcast in the series You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne. The Dreyfus Case was written by Joseph Liss and Mr. Cheyenne. The part of Maître Laborie was played by Joseph DeSantis. Maurice Tarplin was Colonel Dupatie de Clam. Charlotte Holland was Madame Dreyfus. Also in the cast were Juano Hernandez, Tony O. Selvert, and Guy Sorrell.
The Dreyfus Case was broadcast originally by CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System, and rebroadcast for our men and women in the armed services in our series, You Are There. United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.
During the reign of Empress Anna Ivanovna of Russia, cannons and cannonballs were made from blocks of ice, believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you about a terrifying day when a missionary's prayers were answered in flame. Miracles do happen. One happened in the Kyukyu territory in Africa, where Mr. and Mrs. Stuart Watts and their four children had a mission. Bloodthirsty Kyukyus had besieged the Watts mission, declining an offer of military help. The family prayed for a miracle and got one. A blinding light in the sky scared off the savages, caused by a flaming meteor, the first to ever fall in that part of Africa, believe it or not.
The Whisperer, starring Carlton Young. The Whisperer, a brilliant man who, losing his voice in an accident which crushed his vocal cords, worked his way deep within the crime syndicate to help destroy it from within. To the underworld, his familiar rattling hiss is the voice of authority, to be obeyed without question. Then a miracle of surgery performed by Dr. Benjamin Lee restored his natural voice, enabling him to resume his real identity. Now, as Philip Gault, aggressive young attorney, he skirts the thin edge of death, living his dual role. For as the Whisperer, he sets in motion the forces of the syndicate in Central City. Then, as Philip Gault, uses his knowledge to fight the organized network of crime, which seeks to control the fate of millions in cities and towns across the nation.
Now in Philip Galt's oak-paneled law office, we find him at the telephone speaking in the voice of the Whisperer, making his report to a superior in the syndicate in New York.
Hello, New York. Jordan given instructions. Will advise later.
Aha!
Aha yourself. What's in that pretty head of yours?
Brain. I just figured out something.
Yeah, what?
Well, under ordinary circumstances, when you give out with that horrible voice of your alter egos, you instruct someone to kill someone else.
And?
And then you have to break your neck to stop the killing you started in the first place.
In the second place, sweetheart, the syndicate starts it.
Well, anyway, our whole evening is ruined.
Okay, so...
So, tonight I notice you didn't give instructions to have anybody killed. Ergo, that means you don't have to involve yourself in that horrible syndicate business. And you can devote your full attention to paying attention to me.
But, Ellen...
Yeah?
It'll be a pleasure.
Oh, no!
So what's the matter?
Well, you agree with me.
Well, don't I always?
Well, you've got that backwards. It's not don't you always. It's you always don't.
You know what I was thinking?
Should I know?
A place where we can have a nice, leisurely dinner. Look soulfully into each other's eyes over coffee with soft music in the background.
Mm.
And then emerge into the evening in search of entertainment.
Honest, Phil? No syndicate business at all?
Well, nothing pressing.
Phil.
Now relax, sweetheart. You won't be able to digest your food properly if you don't.
It's been so long. So long.
Since we had an evening like this?
Uh-huh. Every second, I think something's going to come along and spoil it.
Nothing can. Only, this thing tonight with Jordan... Why would the syndicate be interested in buying out a fighter's contract?
I don't know, and I don't want to think about it. Look at that woman's hat over there.
Lovely. Of course, it's the fight game, and fighting's been a source of income for gamblers, touts, and fixers almost since boxing took up the Marquess of Queensberry rules.
It isn't lovely. It's monstrous.
What is?
That hat. You haven't been listening to me.
Every word. Now, as soon as you put away that lipstick, we can sally forth and find us some entertainment.
Hmm, any idea what kind? There's a show at the Circle that got wonderful reviews.
As a matter of fact, I have an idea.
Wonderful, darling. Don't tell me. Let it be a surprise.
This last round may have a knockout in it because Sullivan's knees are buckling. And there it comes, a hard left to the middle. An uppercut that snaps Sullivan's head. Oh, this battling Abbey is dynamite. Sullivan is groggy, his eyes are glassy, and I think, yes, the referee is stopping the fight. It's a TKO for Battling
well,
Abbey.
I was looking for a surprise. You did it again,
this is entertainment, sweetheart. This kid Noonan is an up-and-coming youngster.
Well, I thought you liked the fight.
So do you, if it fits in with your plans.
I didn't have any plans.
Hmm.
Now, you sit tight. This won't take but 5 minutes.
What won't? Phil Galt, where are you going?
Back to the dressing rooms. I want to speak to Kid Noonan's manager.
Oh.
Dad, and I don't want you pushing so much tonight. This boy is a counterboxer. He doesn't leave. He waits for you to open up and then he counters. Yeah, what is it?
My name is Galt. I'd like to talk to you, Corky.
No, not now. What kind of brains you got, Galt? The kid's going out there in a few minutes.
Sorry, I didn't know you were giving him last-minute instructions.
Well, I'm all through with him anyway. Keep those muscles rippling. Over here, Galt. We can talk for a couple minutes anyway.
Okay. Nice boy.
Yeah, he's coming. Coming. Not up there yet, but a comer. If I can get him fights.
Yeah? Why can't you?
Gangsters are trying to take over the fight game, Sonny. Lay down, kid. Relax. Relax.
Gangsters?
Yeah.
Does that have anything to do with your face looking like it had an argument with a buzzsaw?
You're not so dumb, Galt.
Oh. But I don't understand why anybody beat you up.
You better you don't understand. Look, what can I do for you?
Well, I was wondering if Kid Noonan's up for sale.
You too.
Me too what?
Wanting to buy the kid.
Oh. Who else wanted to buy him?
The guy who wouldn't take no for an answer and then gave me this going over.
But it was still no?
Yeah, to him and to you. The kid is my boy and I'm keeping him. If I can figure a way to get him some fights.
You don't know this gangster?
No.
He called himself by some name, didn't he?
Smitty. That tell you anything? You're like a fighter with both eyes closed in there swinging against the champ. This Smitty said he was representing someone else. A certain group is the way he put it. But I know who that certain group is.
These gangsters?
The syndicate, Sonny. They've been trying to buy their way into the fight game for months.
Oh, to rig the betting, things like that?
You're getting the idea. control. Who wins what fight? Who gets the big build-up for Chan?
And they're forcing you to sell by making it tough for you to get fights.
Sure, if I can't get fights for my boy, what good is he to me? I might as well sell him.
How do they go about keeping you from getting matches?
Look, getting the right fights arranged for your boy ain't easy in the first place. You gotta pick your spots. See that he comes along gradually, doesn't get in over his head. But my boy happens to have a good right hand. And a lot of fighters don't want to get in the ring with him.
But you just said...
That's just part of it, Sonny. To get a match, I gotta go through a promoter. Somebody who hires the hall, arranges for the promotion, selling tickets, publicity. Well, I'm having trouble with the promoters lately, too.
You mean the promoters are playing along with this syndicate you mentioned?
Maybe playing along, maybe being forced to play along.
Have you taken this up with the boxing commissioners?
Now, what's the use? What are they going to do about it? Look, I got to take my boy out there now. This may be his last fight for a long time.
Suppose I take it up with the boxing commission.
You? Go ahead. Fella by the name of Jordan's your best bet.
Jordan?
Yeah, you know.
I might. And I might, as a lawyer, be able to get Kid Noonan some fights.
Well, you can try. I'll give you a list of the boys I'd like to match him with. If you do...
If I do?
I'll buy your tickets to the kids' fights for the next 10 years.
There's a left, another left, another from Kid Newman. What a sweetheart of a fighter with dynamite in his right hand. And Lefty Johnson's got a lot of respect for it. There's the end of the first round, folks. Here's a word about
Wexler. Nice shoulders on Kid Noonan.
Seems to have a lot of promise, doesn't he?
He can promise me something any old time.
You know, it'd be a shame if his future in boxing were suddenly cut off, wouldn't it?
You mean the syndicate?
Mm-hmm. The kid's in the middle, like between the frying pan and the fire.
Why?
Because if Corky won't sell his contract, the kid won't be able to get any fights. And if the syndicate does buy him, it'll be for their own purposes. Fixed fights, phonies, gambling coups. Mm-hmm. Nice, huh?
Mm-hmm. What can you do about it, sir?
I can stick my nose in and smell around anyway. Now, here comes the second round.
It's the second round. They come out of their corners and meet in the center. Oh, oh, brother. Kid Noonan is going to fool around this time. There's a slashing left. Now, that right cross is over. Lefty's on the rope, hanging on. Now, it's a cinch now. He's got all the time in the world. There it is. Lefty Johnson's down. A short right. It didn't travel either. As we pick up the count, it's 6, 7, 8, 9, and out.
Let's go, Alan. I want to see someone.
Syndicate business.
No, my own. I want to find out about a man named Jordan who's on the boxing commission and how the syndicate goes about keeping Kid Noonan from getting fights. Alan.
Uh-huh.
This fellow Jordan I called up when I used the Whisperer's voice to give instructions.
What about him?
Corky Ballou told me the man to see on the boxing commission is named Jordan, too.
Oh? Same one?
Could be. I don't know. Press in that cigarette lighter, will you, sweetheart?
Oh, no.
Oh, no, what?
It'll set off another one of your gadgets.
No, I just want a cigarette. Here, take one out of my jacket pocket and light it for me, will you?
All right.
No!
What?
Not that case. Put it back. There's an open package of cigarettes in my pocket.
What's the matter with the case?
Ellen!
What?
Don't press that catch. The case is loaded.
Loaded? With what?
Enough explosive to blow this car to kingdom come. Now put it back in my pocket.
Bill Galt, is this another gadget of yours?
A kind of deadly gadget, Ellen. Now just slip it back. Easy. That's fine. Thanks.
What do you expect to do with it?
Well, you can never tell when a situation will come up that demands a little subtlety.
Subtlety? With a miniature atom bomb in your pocket? Here, a cigarette.
Thanks.
Deliver me from a slap happy gadgeteer.
I'll deliver you right to our destination. And here we are. And please don't divert Mr. Jordan's attention while I'm talking to him.
Divert his attention?
By being so ravishing. And you, Miss Norris. It's a pleasure to meet you.
It's a pleasure for me just to look at such a beautiful home, Mr. Jordan.
Thank you.
So being a boxing commissioner must be a good job.
Oh, no, Miss Norris. It's an honorary job. No fee involved at all. I've been lucky in life, Miss Norris.
Oh? You picked the right father? Left you this beautiful house?
Mr. Galt, she's priceless. And that's what I keep telling her. I can't pay her what she's worth. Now tell me, will you have a drink? Scotch? Bourbon?
No, thanks.
Not for me. Well, I'm going to mix one for myself, if you'll excuse me.
Certainly.
Well?
It's him.
Steve Jordan?
I recognize his voice. The one I spoke to on the phone.
Shh. Now, what can I do for you, Mr. Galt?
Well, frankly, Mr. Jordan, I'm here on serious business.
Business that you might not like. I'm an attorney.
Oh?
I have a client who thinks he's being damaged.
Well, have I damaged him?
Indirectly, perhaps. That's what I'm here to find out. My client's name is Corky Ballou.
Oh, the fight manager. Yes, he manages a boy called,
Kid Noonan.
Yes, Kid Noonan. A good fighter. Likely to go places.
That's just it, Mr. Jordan. He's not likely to go places at all. Corky can't get a fight for him.
No?
This one tonight was the last he could arrange.
Well, that's odd. The other fighter's afraid of him?
Perhaps. And perhaps it's that no promoter wants to arrange a fight for him. Mr. Jordan, I think it's possible I may be able to find some kind of monopolistic policy which the courts would frown on.
Well, that's an odd thought.
Well, I don't know why it's odd. There are monopolies in commerce and industry. Why can't there be monopolies in boxing?
Well, I'm not a lawyer.
I am. I wanted to ask you why Kid Noonan can't get any fights in this town.
Well, frankly, Mr. Galt, I don't know.
I see.
However, I'll look into it, if I may.
Certainly.
And I'll call you in the morning, Mr. Galt. Good evening, Miss Norris.
Goodbye.
It was a pleasure meeting you.
Still, I don't believe it.
Believe what?
That Mr. Jordan is mixed up in any way with the syndicate.
He's the Jordan I gave instructions to. He's the one who told someone by the name of Smitty to buy Kid Noonan's contract from Corky Ballou. And when Corky wouldn't sell, Smitty gave him a terrible beating.
Smitty? He must be one of those syndicate's hired killers from out of town.
Uh-huh. Sent here to work on this job with Jordan.
But Mr. Jordan is so cultured, so refined.
Yes. Come on in with me.
Where? This drugstore?
Yeah. I want to make a phone call to New York. Ellen.
It's about time you got through. I
think you can fit in here with me.
Why, Phil Galt, I'd love to try. What is it?
I just got my instructions from New York. I want you to hear me pass them on. Nice, refined Mr. Jordan. That's how much you can take a woman's intuition.
Hello? Jordan.
Yes?
New instructions. Corky Ballou will be at his training camp at Rosedale Lake tomorrow.
Rosedale Lake tomorrow. Instructions?
You will see to.
You are listening to The Whisperer, the story of Philip Galt, who skirts the thin edges of danger, living his dual role. After failing in their plan to buy Kid Noonan's contract from his manager, Corky Ballou, the syndicate has instructed the Whisperer to pass on the orders for Corky's death. Now, Philip Galt, alias the Whisperer, must prevent this murder and still retain the secret of his double identity.
Come in for a minute, Phil.
Thanks.
Been so quiet all the way here.
Well, I've been quiet. I've been thinking, Ellen.
I can see where that would take up your whole attention.
Seriously, we're in it now.
We? You're the one who always puts us in it, passing along those horrible instructions.
Mm-hmm, and I'm right back at the starting point. Jordan will tell this Smitty to kill Corky Ballou. But who is Smitty? What does he look like?
It's always the same, Phil.
Yes, but in this case, we've got a lead.
Rosedale Lake.
That's right. Training camp for Corky's fighters. He'll probably get back there late tonight or early tomorrow. And Jordan will have passed on his information to Smitty. It's too bad you have to work tomorrow.
Who said I have to? Dr. Lee's in Philadelphia. A medical convention. And the office is closed for 2 whole days.
Oh. Well, it's a long, grueling trip and...
And I love a trip. And Phil?
Huh?
Jordan is slimy. I don't just plain old hate him. I loathe him.
I know what you mean. But don't let your emotions carry you away.
Something I wish would happen to you.
What?
Here you take me out for an evening, drive me home. I invite you in. And what do? Make love to me? Tell me what your emotions are doing to you? No.
Come here.
No, thanks.
Come here.
No.
I said come here.
Well, if you put it like that.
The syndicate works in many ways, and this was a new one even to Phil Galt, alias the Whisperer. With their ramified network operating at top efficiency, they are trying to gain control of a large block of the fighting interest throughout the nation.
with one tentacle of the giant octopus reaching into Central City. After Phil had said goodnight to Ellen, he drove back to his apartment, trying to figure out how he could put a stop to the syndicate's plans. Towards morning, he fell into a restless sleep, and...
Hello.
Hello, Galt.
You're speaking.
Oh, didn't I awaken you?
Yes, you did, Jordan. What time is it?
It's 8:30. A good attorney should be out of bed and in his office by this time.
Who said I was good?
I'm leaving on a little trip, Galt, and I've got some information for you. If you'd like to drop by my office.
Sure.
Could you make it in about half an hour?
Right.
Matter after all, Galt. There's always an explanation for everything.
You're referring to Kid Noonan?
Yes, that's right. The answer is that there are only two or three fighters who will take a chance with him in the ring.
Just a moment. I have a list somewhere in my pocket. Corky Ballou gave it to me. Here it is.
Now, may I see it?
Certainly. Those are the fighters Corky'd like to have Kid Noonan fight.
And none of them are available.
Well, that was quick checking you did, Jordan.
Huh? Oh, well, it's my business, Galt. When I undertook to become a member of the commission, I decided I'd do the best job I could for the best interests of boxing.
I wish more of our public servants had that kind of outlook.
Yes. I spoke to two promoters this morning. Both of them have a peculiar attitude about Kid Noonan.
Oh, what's that?
They don't want to do business with Corky Ballou.
Any particular reason?
They both said he was difficult to deal with, and they'd just as soon fill their cards with fighters not managed by him.
So there are two reasons why Kid Noonan won't be able to get fights. No fighters available, and the promoters won't play with Corky. That's a double squeeze, Jordan.
Well, there you have it, Galt. If Corky wants a fight with the champ...
Corky says the kid's not ready for the champ yet.
Then there's nothing else I can tell you. As you can see, there is no indication of a blackball or, how did you say it, monopolistic practices.
It's a pretty quick whitewash, Jordan. But thanks for the promptness, anyway.
Not at all.
It's about time you came out.
Ellen, what are you doing here?
I called you at home. You weren't there. I thought you'd left for Rosedale Lake without me, and I was furious. And then I suspected you'd be calling on Jordan, and I looked up his business address, and, well, here I am.
So I see. Ellen, this is going to be dangerous.
I'm going.
It's getting more and more complicated, and if I don't spot Smitty, I don't know how to stop this thing. But I did make a phone call.
Mm-hmm.
No, not to the syndicate. To a friend of yours.
Mine?
Well, he was much more attracted to you than he was to me. Tommy Fell, the reporter. You remember him.
Oh, you're not mixing him up in this thing.
There are two problems we have, sweetheart.
Let's get started. It's a long drive.
Okay.
Two problems, you said. I know one, to save Corky Ballou from the city.
That's right. And the second is, what's to become of Kid Noonan? How's he going to get fights? Because even if we succeed in saving Corky, the syndicate doesn't forget. And the syndicate won't give up its plans to get their hands on Kid Noonan's contract.
So you called Tommy Farrell?
Publicity, sweetheart. If the papers make enough noise about a fighter not being allowed to fight, then the syndicate won't press. They can't. The way they operate, it's always got to be undercover.
Well, what's Tommy going to do?
First, he wants to make sure what I told him is the truth. He's flying up to Rosedale Lake this afternoon.
Flying?
Now, one of his pals lends him his helicopter whenever he needs it.
Oh, beats driving, doesn't it?
Well, aren't you enjoying the drive?
Yes, Bill. It's what we're driving toward that I'm not enjoying. Oh, it's beautiful, Phil. Look at the sun sparkle on the water. And air so clean.
There's the hotel. We'll drive around the back.
There's a boxing ring, Phil.
Punching bags, equipment. Nobody's here, though. Say, how about some lunch in the hotel, and then we'll look up Corky?
Well, maybe he's not here.
He'll be here, sweetheart. The syndicate doesn't make mistakes. And they said he'd be here. He's shown up yet, Ellen. Finished with your lunch?
All finished.
Let's go, then. We'll ask around. Corky's the kind of a guy I think wouldn't pass up lunch.
Tommy! Tommy!
Farrell, where is he? Oh.
Hi, kids.
Oh, just get in?
Uh-huh. Why, don't you look like the cat that ate the canary?
Me?
You?
It wasn't canary. It was chicken fricassee. And very good, too. Both helping.
For lunch?
With Phil, I never know if I'll eat dinner at a reasonable hour.
Or if you'll eat at all, from what I can gather.
Well, what's the gizmo with Corky Ballou? If things are so urgent, what are you hanging around here for?
Where should I hang around?
His bungalow.
Bungalow? Doesn't he live here in the hotel?
Of course not. Oh, I forgot. You wouldn't know. Me, I've been up here so many times, the woods are like little brothers to me.
We'd better hurry.
Suppose you hurry, Phil. I'll go down to the lake with Ella.
Fine. Just what I was going to suggest.
Oh, no. You're not getting away like that, Phil Gault. We're coming along. Besides, Tommy has to show you the way.
Well, then let's go. You didn't see Corky last night, Farrell? His face was a mess. Good going over because he wouldn't sell the kid. Now I'm afraid the ones who want to buy aren't going to stop with a beating.
The syndicate?
That's right. Ellen, you all right?
All right.
Aren't we near his place, Farrell?
Pretty close. They're moving into the boxing racket, huh?
Already moved in.
Yeah, I kind of smell that here and there.
Smell will get worse. The only thing that can help is publicity. Lots of it.
Well, I'm your boy. Oh, through that brush over there.
Yeah. That it?
All right. Now, there are a couple of more bungalows farther on, but this is the one Corky uses himself.
We don't see any signs of him.
Yeah, let's go in. We can see if he's around.
All right.
Come in. Come in.
Phil, a gun.
Uh-huh.
Well, I said come in.
I never thought I'd be able to do it. He took his eyes off me. He didn't know I had a gun. I got it late last night.
Take it easy, Corky.
Yeah, take it easy. What was going on?
Hey,
here. Sit down.
He was going to take me to the lake and shoot me.
Nice business.
Because I wouldn't sell Kid's contract.
Yeah, looks like you tagged another story for me, Gold.
Yeah. Look, Corky, you haven't got a thing to worry about. Huh? I knew it was coming. That's why I came up here.
How did you know, Gold?
Huh?
Put up your hands. You, Corky, drop the gun.
So, this was the little trip you mentioned, Jordan.
Yes, that's right. What are you doing here, Gault?
Well, Corky's my client, remember?
Yes. And how did you know what was going to happen?
It wasn't hard to figure, Jordan. Not after the beating Corky took yesterday.
It's beginning to look to me like you knew quite a bit of the deal. Perhaps you were in on the whole thing, Gault.
Oh?
I've been investigating. Someone wanted to buy you out, Corky.
Huh?
Didn't Smitty tell you he was representing someone else?
That's right.
Maybe it was Gault here.
He did say something about...
Now, you see, you never know who you can trust, Corky. Now, wouldn't you say that if the tables were turned and Gault had this gun, he'd shoot all of us?
I don't think so, Jordan.
I seem to remember your face. Who are you?
Tommy Farrell.
Oh, yes, a newspaper man.
A newspaper man who knows a story when he sees it, Jordan. How did you know this gunman here?
I didn't know him.
You knew his name?
Or did I? That must have slipped out.
So you can drop the act, Jordan. We all know what you are and who you work for.
Now, that's a shame, especially for Miss Norris here. I'd really grown quite fond of her. She has an unusual wit. It touches a responsive chord in me. All right, now stand up, Corky.
Sure.
Take your hands out of your pocket, Gault.
I was just going for a cigarette. Do you mind?
Well, you won't need it.
Oh, come now, Jordan. The condemned man is always granted a last request.
Certainly, Mr. Gault. Pass them around, if you like.
Phil.
Of course, sweetheart. One for you, too. The catch on this cigarette case is sometimes hard to release.
Phil, no.
What is it?
That case, it's explosive. There's enough dynamite in there. Phil, don't press that case.
What's the difference? Dynamite or Jordan's gun? I might just as well press this.
Oh, no!
Here. Okay, drop it. Come on, still up. Corky. You.
I shot him.
A good job, too, Corky. He's dead.
That's twice.
Phil.
What, sweetheart?
You were going to press that catch and blow us all to smithereens. You were going to, I know.
Of course, sweetheart.
Ah!
You never can tell what a woman will scream at, pal. Let this be a lesson to you.
It wasn't loaded.
With cigarettes?
You tricked me.
Uh-huh.
You knew I'd be frightened.
Yes, dear, and raise a commotion in case I needed one. Corky.
I never even shot a gun before today. The police. What'll they do?
Nothing. It was self-defense, Corky.
Yeah. Oh, I'll call them.
Corky, are you coming into Central City soon?
Tonight.
How about driving my car down for me? I want to find out what a helicopter ride is like. Well, they won't
won't be able to keep Kid Noonan from getting fights now. Not when every newspaper in the country exposes the syndicate moving in on a boxing game.
That's what I thought. You newspaper men have your points after all.
I always thought so, too.
It would be real nice up here in the clouds if there are only two of us.
Now, don't be bashful, fell. Anything you want to tell me, you can say in front of Ellen.
Getting a little airsick, Galt? Be glad to drop you off anywhere.
No, no, feel fine.
You have a spare parachute.
I wouldn't think of taking a spare, fell. Suppose Ellen had to get out and thumb around.
You keep it up, boys. It's building the old ego. There's only one thing, Tommy, that makes me stick so close to Phil.
Well, tell me, I'll cultivate it.
His gadget. Like that cigarette case thing.
That was a psychological gadget, Ellen.
Would that make it a psychological case?
Oh, Ellen.
That does it. Ellen, you can use that parachute anytime.
Based upon stories and characters created by Stetson Humphrey. Any similarity to persons living or dead is purely coincidental. Carlton Young is starred as the Whisperer. Betty Moran is Ellen. Others in the cast were Sidney Miller, Julius Kralbein, Jack Moyles, and Eddie Fields. The Whisperer was written by Jonathan Twice, produced and directed by Bill Karn, original music by Johnny Duffy. This is Don Rickles inviting you to listen next week to another exciting adventure with
The Whisperer.
It's the Silver Jubilee on NBC. Today you'll want to hear the further adventures of the Mary Vanderhoff household as Academy Award winner Walter Brennan appears as Grandpa Vanderhoff on You Can't Take It With You. Later there's Adventure in International Intrigue with Mr. Moto. Then genial Phil Baker comes to the NBC microphone prepared to pay handsomely if you come up with the answer to his all-important $64 question. Hear all three today on NBC.
That's going to do it for today's show. I hope you liked what you heard. If not, visit relicradio.com. There's all kinds of shows there waiting for your download. There's also links to our forum, Shoutcast stream, Facebook page, and everything else Relic Radio. If you'd like to help support this and all the shows, you can do so from the website as well. Just click on the red donation information button for more on that. And as always, thank you very much to those who have. Thank you for joining me today. Talk to you again next Tuesday with another episode of the Relic Radio Show. Relic Radio Show is produced by and for RelicRadio.com. Rebroadcast of this show without permission is strictly prohibited.